disempowered and reduced to second-class citizens. The very nature of the decisions taken on August the 5th was aimed at political disempowerment of one dominant community. That's the primary concern of people here.
Welcome back, Mr. Mehdi. Since 2019, the government has altered property rights of locals, triggering widespread suspicion amongst locals that the new laws are part of Modi's scheme to change the demography of India's only Muslim-majority region. Now, my question is, has the government succeeded to promote right-wing Hindutva, and has the Indian government succeeded in creating Hindu settlements there on the model of Palestine in a bid to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region?
Well, the abrogation of Article 370 to end the special status of Jammu and Kashmir state was a long-standing demand of the Nationalist Hindu Party in Delhi, BJP, which is presently ruling India. One of the main objectives behind this move was to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region, and by allowing Hindus inland India to come and buy properties in Kashmir Valley. Replicating the Israeli model in Palestine. Under Article 370 and Article 35A, which is part of this article, people from outside Kashmir, non-Kashmiris, were not allowed to buy land in Kashmir. But this article, when they revoked this article 2 years ago, everything changed. According to the last census, which was in 2011, the population of entire Jammu and Kashmir state is around 12.5 million, which has increased now. And Muslims comprise around 70% of this population. Since August 5, 2 years ago, 2019, Delhi has unilaterally introduced laws related to law and domicile status, which clearly and emphatically seek to change Kashmir's demography and economically disempower Kashmiris. Scores of Indian Hindus from mainland India have already been given domicile certificates and under this new citizenship law, under which non-Kashmiris are now entitled to jobs and residency in Kashmir, which was otherwise reserved only for the local Kashmiris before this article was revoked. So it's quite clear there were the designs of India's ruling BJP party has in Kashmir, despite all the tall talk about economic progress and social empowerment. So it's clear.
Before we take a break, I would like to thank Mr. Zafar Mehdi for being on the program. Now let's see how people on social media see the situation in Kashmir.
Former Kashmir lawmaker Mohammad Yusuf Tarigami says the abrogation of Article 370 by New Delhi delegitimized the mainstream political space in Kashmir. He was one of the senior pro-India politicians put under house arrest on August 5, 2019. Another tweet is by Satindra Kulkarni. That's an Indian politician and newspaper columnist. Those who believe that measures taken on August 5, 2019 solved the Kashmir issue have fallen victim to propaganda. He asserts that Kashmiris feel hurt, humiliated and betrayed. P. Chidambaram calls the revocation of Article 370 in Kashmir an unconstitutional coup and the desecration of democracy, while expressing solidarity with the people of the troubled state.
Every year, on the early days of Muharram, a great number of Muslims and non-Muslims across the world mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam and the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them. Mourners take to the streets for rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month to pay their respect and express the unison amongst all Muslim communities in the love for Imam Hussein.
Every year, Shia Muslims, along with a lot of other people around the world, hold mourning rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month of Muharram. The mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein and his companions reach their peak on the 9th day of Muharram, or Tasua, and the 10th day, or Ashura. Ashura marks the martyrdom anniversary of Hussein ibn Ali, Hazrat Imam Hussein, who was martyred in the Battle of Karbala in October 680 AD, or Muharram in 61 AH, nearly 14 centuries ago. The accounts of his heartbreaking martyrdom sent shockwaves through the Muslim world as he was widely seen as a hero who sacrificed his life to challenge the corrupt ruler, Yazid ibn Muawiyah.
Imam Hussein's message is an iconic message. It's a message that crosses all nationalities, all religions, anyone who has a heart beating in their chest can actually appreciate and understand. Because there are many aspects, as I said, you know, the martyrdom of his, you know, six-month-old baby, Hazrat Ali Azhar, or his son, 18-year-old son, Ali Akbar, being martyred, or his brother, Hazrat Abbas, who, you know, was a commander of the army, or, you know, Imam Hussein's friend coming to join him when he was in his late 80s. So all kinds of fascinating human angles come out of it. Secondly, of course, you know, the viciousness of Yazid's oppression against this small group of people who were standing against the oppressor, the oppressive regime of that time, also resonates very well with the current circumstances of what's happening globally, if you like. That's why, I talked about in the historical sense, but if you look at it in the last 30, 40 years, since the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, where Imam Khomeini actually used the iconography of Karbala to motivate the Iranian masses, similarly, people in the subcontinent and far afield, even in other places, can actually resonate very well that, what is oppression and so on.
Morning of Muharram is an opportunity to unite all Muslims behind the cause of Imam Hussein's uprising against tyranny. In addition to the Indian and Pakistani Muslims, myriads of other ethno-linguistic and religious majorities and minorities of the subcontinent consider Imam Hussein as a symbol of resistance and protest against the oppressive powers.
The people of the subcontinent are no stranger to revolt against imperialism due to their shared history of occupation and exploitation. The Muslim community or any other people who feel oppressed and voiceless can view the mourning of Muharram and Imam Hussein as the great unifier. Imagine what feats of human accomplishment might be possible if India, Pakistan, Bangladesh and the rest of South Asia act as one body towards feasible solutions for other problems of the Islamic population.
This year's Muharram comes at a time when mourning ceremonies are held under many pandemic-related health protocols amid fears of another devastating wave of the coronavirus. Indoor gatherings are prohibited, while mourners were advised to hold the rituals in open areas such as squares and streets, instead of traditional places such as mosques and Husseinias.
If you look at India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, the whole population of that big mass of land, which is also in old historical maps called Barre-Saghir, meaning, you know, a continent in its own right. The population of that region is 1.6 billion, 1.7 billion, out of which about 400 to 500 million are Muslims, 250 million in India, 220 million in Pakistan, and another about 160 odd million in Bangladesh, Muslims I'm talking about. So you're talking about at least half a billion Muslims living in that big landmass. And normally statistics are that between 20 to 25% constitute Shias, if you like. So you're talking about well over 100 million Shias living in the subcontinent, more than Iranian population, and perhaps if you add together the whole of the West Asia, there are more Shias living in the subcontinent than the whole of West Asia. So you can see the numbers are quite huge. So of course, you know, historically, as I said earlier, the impact of Imam Hussein's message has been profound. And of course, historically, a lot of Iranians from Iran during Nadir Shah and subsequently moved to, and I'm not talking about the Parsis, who were Zoroastrians who moved to India, but also the followers of the Ahlul Bayt who moved to India over the last 300-400 years. They also brought the custom and the practice of Azadari to the Indian subcontinent. And there are two key places, if you like, in India where the whole Azadari took root. One is Hyderabad Dakkan in the south of India, and the other is Lucknow. These were two princedoms, if you like. Nizam of Hyderabad was a remarkable character, although he came from a Sunni school of thought, but he was a lover of Ahlul Bayt, and he provided a lot of facilities, built a lot of Husseiniyas, provided educational facilities, and the impact of Azadari was quite profound on the subcontinent.
Members of the mourning congregation stage processions listening to eulogies about Imam Hussein while beating drums as a symbol of remembering the Battle of Karbala. As well as weeping and beating chests, votive cooking or Nazri is an integral part of the ceremonies. Nazri foods are served or distributed among the mourners and passers-by.
And that was our episode on the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir 2 years after the controversial revocation of the so-called semi-autonomous status. We also talked about the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, that are held annually during the first days of Muharram. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you, as usual, from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us again. Our topic today is a continuation of the previous program topic of cursing, the use of curses in the ziyarat, in these prayers of salutation to either Allah or Imams and so on forth. We mentioned some few points regarding the topic of cursing. We firstly said that there is a difference between cursing and swearing. Swearing is disencouraged in Islam, but cursing is encouraged, and cursing has been used multiple times by Allah the Exalted himself in the Quran, and we also mentioned that the prophets and the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all, also used to curse the enemies of Allah. And we mentioned that cursing is reserved for those who are deserving of it, and only them. Dear Sheikh, please enlighten us further.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We also mentioned that when it comes to those few people who are holy personalities for our Sunni brothers and sisters, according to the famous verdict of our greatest scholars, as Shias, we are not allowed to curse them.
And we stress this again for our dear listeners.
Exactly. As I mentioned, some people, according to Sunni sources, in some of the narrations, the Holy Prophet has cursed a group of people, for example, those who drink alcohol, those who give and take usury. But in some cases, according to Sunni sources, the Holy Prophet has mentioned some people by name and has cursed them, like Abu Marwan and Marwan ibn Hakam and Hakim ibn al-As. When it comes to Abu Sufyan and his son Muawiyah, according to some narrations in Sunni sources, the Holy Prophet has cursed these two people as well. Now, our Sunni brothers' view regarding Muawiyah is different. Some of them, they also take him as a holy personality, but not as holy as the first three caliphs. But some of them, they know about the crimes committed by Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan. So there are differences of ideas among the Sunnis as well. But interestingly, according to some narrations, these two people, Abu Sufyan and his son Muawiyah, has been cursed by the Prophet. In one narration, a person named Ali ibn Akmari says that we asked Abdullah ibn Umar to tell us a narration from the Prophet. And he said that once three people came, were going toward the Prophet. One of them was Abu Sufyan riding, maybe a camel. Muawiyah was in front of him, walking, and his brother was behind them, also walking. And the Holy Prophet said, Allahumma al-han al-qa'id wa-sa'iq wa-raqib. O Allah, curse the one who is in front, who is behind, and the one who is riding.
So all three of them
all three
cursed.
Of them. So people were surprised and said that, Anta sami'ta Rasulullah, did you really hear the Holy Prophet saying that? He said, yes. And qala na'am, he said, yes. Abdullah ibn Umar in another narration says that the Holy Prophet, on the day of the Battle of Uhud, he said, Allahumma al'an Abu Sufyan. O Allah, curse Abu Sufyan. Bara ibn Azib is quoted as saying that once Abu Sufyan and his son Muawiyah were going toward the Prophet, the Holy Prophet said, Allahumma al'an at-tabi'a wal-matbu'a. O Allah, curse the one who is in front and the one who is following him. When it comes to, because sometimes, some of the Sunnis, they accuse Shia of, cursing some of the companions of the Prophet. The fact is that when we refer to the Sunni sources, we see that the companions of the Prophet, which according to Sunnis, all of them they are righteous, they used to curse each other too.
So the righteous companions who are righteous curse each other as well?
Yeah, a righteous companion curses another righteous companion, and this is interesting. For example, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, who is one of the companions of the Prophet, in a letter to Muawiyah, he curses Muawiyah and his father. He says, "Antal la'in ibn al-la'in." We are talking about the son of the first caliph, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr. And addressing Muawiyah, he says that you are cursed, son of the cursed. That is Abu
Sufyan. That's quite a big curse for those who do not understand Arabic.
Yeah. لم تزل أنت وأبوك تبغيان لرسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم القوائل وتجهدان في إطفاء نور الله. O Muawiyah, you and your father, you were trying your best to,
distinguish the light of Allah.
Distinguish the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's been mentioned about a person called Nu'man or Nu'iman that he was used to drink alcohol. And he was also one of the companions of the Prophet. فَقَالَ بَعْضُ الصَّحَابَةِ لَعَنَهُ اللَّهُ مَا أَكْثَرَ مَا يُؤْتَى بِهِ. So it happened at the time of the Prophet, according to Sunni criteria, he is a companion of the Prophet, but he used to drink alcohol. So, and in different cases, he was punished for that. And in a session, some of the companions of the Prophet, they said, لَعَنَهُ اللَّهُ, may Allah's curse be upon him. In the story, in the event, in the Battle of Siffin, we know that we had the event of Hakamiyyah or arbitration, and how Abu Musa Ash'ari, the so-called representative of Imam Ali al-Salam, was deceived by Amr ibn al-As. And then Abu Musa Ash'ari told Amr ibn al-As that لَعَنَكَ اللَّهُ فَإِنَّ مَثَلَكَ كَمَثَلِ الْكَلْبِ إِنْ تَحْمِلْ عَلَيْهِ يَلْهَثْ أَوْ تَتْرُكُ يَلْهَثْ. May Allah's curse be upon you, you are like a dog, which is mentioned in the Quran.
Right.
And also, we have two people who are highly regarded by our Sunni brothers. One of them is the second caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab, and the other one is Khalid ibn al-Walid. But we know that in a shameful event, Khalid ibn al-Walid killed a righteous person called Malik ibn Nawaira. It's a very shameful story about Khalid ibn al-Walid. According to the Sunni sources, Umar ibn al-Khattab cursed Khalid ibn al-Walid for killing Malik ibn Nawaira. Now, this is the question. You, as Sunnis, believe in these two people as righteous, and one of them is cursing the other. So how come both of them can be...
There's a paradox here. Yeah. That they cannot both be righteous if they are cursing at each other.
Exactly. Now, after, this introduction, now we come to the ziyarat of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and the people who are cursed in these ziyarat, for example, ziyarat of Ashura. We read in a part of ziyarat of Ashura that فَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ أُمَّةً أَسَّسَتْ أَسَاذَ الظُّلْمِ وَالْجَوْرِ عَلَيْكُمْ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ. We are killing those people who oppressed Ahlul Bayt. Now, this is a question.
You're cursing them.
We are cursing those people who oppressed the Ahlul Bayt. Ahlul Bayt, according to chapter Ahzab, verse 33, are purified and from any impurity. There are many narrations in Sunni sources about the virtues of the Ahlul Bayt. The Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, according to Sahih Sitta, after me, I'm leaving behind two precious things, the Book of God and my Ahlul Bayt. So we are cursing those people who oppress the Ahlul Bayt. Now, this is a question, what is wrong with that? When it comes to those people who killed Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, I would like to share some narrations from Sunni sources to know that who Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is. I mean, who are the killers and the murderers of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and to see if we are justified for cursing them or not. There is a famous narration mentioned by many Shia and Sunni scholars. The Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, Al-Hasan wal-Husayn Sayyida Shabab Ahlul Jannah. Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam are the chiefs of the youth of paradise. So these people have killed the chief of the youth of paradise.
And we should note that this narration, it is mutlaq, it is absolute. There's not a time
exactly.
condition or specific
exactly.
here. You said that they are, not that they will be or mm-hmm. they were, mm-hmm. they
That's
are.
That's a very good point. Another narration, again mentioned by Sunni scholars, let me just read the translation. Usama ibn Zayd is quoted as saying that, I came to the Prophet one night concerning some need. So the Prophet came out while he was covering up something, and I didn't know what it was. Once I had, he continues the narration and then he says that, I asked the Prophet, what is that you are covering up? The Holy Prophet uncovered it and I found that it was Hassan and Hussein, alayhi salam, with the Prophet. The Holy Prophet said, these are my two sons and the sons of my daughter. Allahumma inni uhibbuhuma, O Allah, indeed I love them. فَأَحِبَّهُمَا You love them, وَأَحِبْ مَنْ يُحِبُّهُمَا And love those who love them.
Another clear indicator of the status of the two imams.
Exactly. And another interesting narration quoted by Sunni scholars is that Abdurrahman ibn Abu Nu'm, he narrates that a man from the people of Iraq, he asked Ibn Umar, Abdullah ibn Umar, about the blood of maybe a mosquito or a gnat that gets on the clothes, maybe during the prayer, for example. And Ibn Umar was he became very furious and angry. He said that, look at this man. He asks me about the blood of the mosquito and gnat while they kill the son of the Messenger of Allah. So this is Ibn Umar talking about how great this crime was. وسمعت رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم يقول I heard the Prophet say إن الحسن والحسين هما ريحانتا من الدنيا حسن and حسين are my two good smelling flowers in this world.
So all these narrations are pointing to the same thing, the status and how righteous the Imam was, who was murdered, slaughtered even.
Exactly. If I have time, I may share one, two more narrations. Another narration reads that the Holy Prophet was asked, "Ayyu ahl baytika ahabbu ilayk?" Which one of your ahlul bayt, people of your house, are most beloved to you? According to this narration, the Holy Prophet said, "Al Hasan wal Husayn." So these people have killed Imam al Husayn alayhi salam, who is the most beloved person to our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. And the last narration that is very interesting is that once the Holy Prophet was giving a sermon to the Muslims, and then Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, who were very, young and small children at that time, they came toward the Prophet, but they were, walking and falling down.
Right.
They were not maybe able to walk. According to this narration, فَنَزَلَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ, the Holy Prophet is giving a sermon. But he descended from the pulpit, he hugged them and put them in front of him. And then he said the following, he said that, I saw that these two children of mine, they are walking and they are falling down. فَلَمْ أَصْبِرْ حَتَّى قَتَعْتُ حَدِيثِي وَرَفَعْتُهُمَا. I was not patient to see this scene, to see that they are falling down. So I cut, I stopped my sermon and I went to take them.
How beautiful.
So for falling down, the Holy Prophet is cutting his sermon. And these people, they have martyred Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in that very tragic way.
Are we allowed to curse them? And cursing here, it is actually an expression of our faith.
Mm-hmm.
Cursing the enemies who killed the grandson of the Prophet. And dear listeners, you've heard how important this Imam was. And on that sad and sobering thought, we must end today's program. Dear listeners, I thank you for tuning in, and I thank our dear Sheikh for enlightening us. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهرا باللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
With the United States seemingly returning to waging an active air war in Somalia, Africa's recent press releases should raise concern that it may be backtracking on providing transparent reporting of the impact of its airstrikes. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by David Sternman, writer. This article is published under the heading, Is U.S. Military Backtracking on Airstrikes Transparency? Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. On July 20th, the United States conducted its first strike in Somalia since the Biden administration took office, or at least the first strike acknowledged by the U.S. military's Africa Command, or AFRICOM. For the first 6 months of Biden's term, the previously high pace of U.S. strikes in Somalia, as tracked by New America, seemed to have paused, likely in part due to the administration's review of policies regarding counterterrorism strikes. Since the July 20th strike, AFRICOM has reported two more sets of strikes, one on July 23rd and one in August 1st. With the United States seemingly returning to waging an active air war in Somalia, AFRICOM's recent press releases should raise concern that it may be backtracking on providing transparent reporting of the impact of its strikes. Notably, none of these press releases provide details on the assessed number of casualties or other damage, except to note that AFRICOM assesses no civilians were killed or injured in the strikes. In contrast, prior to the Biden administration taking office, AFRICOM had released 5 press releases acknowledging strikes in Somalia. Of these, all but one reported an assessed death toll for those not believed to be civilians. On January 2, 2021, AFRICOM acknowledged an airstrike in a press release, an updated version of which reads in part, "Current assessments indicate the strike killed 3 and wounded 1 members of Al-Shabaab and destroyed 6 and damaged 1 Al-Shabaab compound buildings." On January 7, 2021, AFRICOM released a statement regarding a strike that reads in part, "Initial assessments indicate the strike killed 5 Al-Shabaab members, including the targeted Al-Shabaab leaders." On January 13, 2021, an AFRICOM press release included the language, "Initial assessments indicate the strike killed 1 Al-Shabaab personnel and destroyed 1 compound." 5 days later, AFRICOM released the only press release of 2021 prior to the Biden administration taking office that did not report an assessed number of non-civilian deaths and injuries. However, it did provide a report on the other battle damage, reading, "Initial assessments indicate the strike destroyed 1 Al-Shabaab compound." Finally, 2 days before Biden took office, AFRICOM released a statement that read in part, "Initial assessments indicate the strikes killed 3 Al-Shabaab operatives." The language recounted above is notably absent from the 3 strikes under the Biden administration. It is possible that such assessments will be forthcoming in the future and are just delayed by difficulties in conducting the assessment or the need to protect sources. The July 20th press release, for example, stated a battle damage assessment is still pending due to the ongoing engagement between Al-Shabaab and Somali forces. However, the command's initial assessment is that no civilians were injured or killed as a result of this strike, as the strike targeted known Al-Shabaab fighters and took place in a remote area. Air Wars, which also tracks U.S. strikes in Somalia, notes, Somali state media claimed that at least 20 Al-Shabaab fighters were killed in the strike. The July 23rd press release stated in part, "The command's initial assessment is that no civilians were injured or killed given the remote nature of where this engagement occurred," and concluded, "Due to operational security, U.S. Africa Command is unable to release further information at this time." As Air Wars reports, the Somali Ministry of Information stated that the precision strike only destroyed Al-Shabaab fighters and weapons with 0 civilian casualties. However, the August 1st press release provides no such possible explanation for the lack of damage assessment beyond civilian casualties. Meanwhile, a statement from Somalia's Information Ministry reads in part, "The airstrikes destroyed a large Al-Shabaab firing position engaging Danab and SNA Somali National Army forces as they approached." Air Wars noted that it has seen no local reports of civilian harm from the strikes covered by the August 1st press release, and that a pro-Al-Shabaab outlet said that no casualties generally were reported from the strikes. While it is possible that AFRICOM will release more detailed assessments of the impact of these strikes, that there have now been three strikes under the Biden administration with no public description of casualty assessments beyond civilian casualties is worrisome. This is particularly the case as the military has a tendency to contend that there is no good reason to release body counts of its strikes. Reporting the deaths and injuries American strikes cause, even among those assessed not to be civilians, is important. There are deep moral issues with refusing to let the public see the impact of American strikes. As journalist Spencer Ackerman has recently written, refusing to tally the dead ensured that the work of naming the dead would be minimal, periodic, and incomplete. Adding, rendering people into statistics would have been dehumanizing enough, but they were not even statistics. Ackerman correctly identifies the way that only naming the civilian dead also plays into the U.S. government's flawed and often wrong assessments of who is a civilian, hampering efforts to check such conclusions. Not reporting casualties when they are not reported to be civilians also papers over the ways in which the damage and human pain of American warfare cannot be reduced to legalistic categories. There are real questions regarding how much moral weight can truly be placed on the belligerent-civilian distinction when belligerents tend to lack an ability to cause harm to those targeting them remotely. As was the case in the three strikes during the Biden administration, each of which involved airstrikes called in support of Somalia forces advised remotely by U.S. forces who were not on the ground. And finally, it is worth considering how not providing assessments of casualties beyond civilians can warp assessments of the threat posed by terrorist groups. For example, a lack of discussion of the toll of U.S. airstrikes against Daesh helped inflate the perceived number of foreign fighters in Syria and thus presumably the public's fear of Daesh by using a count that could not only grow discussing the extent to which foreign fighters were being killed. There are moral and strategic reasons to be concerned when the apparent lack of detailed assessments of all the casualties in the United States' recent strikes in Somalia. With luck, AFRICOM will release further detail in the coming weeks and months, and the lack of detail can be chalked up to the difficulties of making quick and accurate assessments in the types of strikes seen so far under the Biden administration. But lack of detail so far should give pause. And if the context of recent strikes makes it more difficult to report assessments quickly, that should itself be part of the considerations of the recent re-escalation of U.S. strikes in Somalia.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners, dear audience, dear youth. Welcome to Youth Station on IRIB English Radio with me brother Yasser Ibrahim and my dear sister Zainab.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Wow, that was the most like formal, well-kept, academic opening to the show ever. We have this other brother on the show, and he literally makes a train noise.
What?
He literally goes choo-choo. Yeah, that's the kind of vibe we try to maintain here, bro. We're all about the chill. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. This is Youth Station. And yeah, so since we are, I don't know, we're recording this on almost like the eve of Muharram, mm-hmm. right? I'm not sure when is it going to get aired or when you guys are going to get to listen to it, but it's probably going to be Muharram and Safar. So we're just trying to talk about topics that youth can mostly relate to during these occasions. And one thing that comes to mind often, and it's a question that presses against the minds of the youth, is has Muharram, this whole thing that we do, has it turned more into a ceremony, a ceremonial ritual thing? Or with the passing of time and ages, we are coming to a better realization of its philosophy? I think both, yeah.
Maybe. I mean, when you went to your first majlis, how did you feel? What did you take from it? If you can remember your first
My first majlis? But now I really feel that the youth, especially nowadays, are really woke.
Depends. Like, there are within communities those who are. They want to do something. And there are those who just take it as a cultural thing.
I think by youth, I mean like people between the ages of 18 and 30.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about that. Not like anybody younger, for example. There are those who see Muharram as a break.
From what?
From the hustle and bustle of life. Because especially now in this pandemic, a lot of things were happening online. People were kind of jamming things in quickly.
Mm-mm.
Before Muharram. Mm-mm. Normally happens, right? That you jam things in before Muharram.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All the weddings.
Weddings and family meals.
Whatever
you need to catch up on.
That last picnic.
Yeah, basically. And then Muharram comes and it's like, okay, there's nothing to do because you're not involved in anything.
Mm.
So you're kind of chill.
Mm.
Except maybe if you want to go to the majalis or listen to one online at this moment. But it was, I think, before the Islamic Revolution, it didn't have the sense that it has now.
Agreed.
Anywhere in the world.
I really feel like after the Islamic Revolution, one of the amazing things that Imam Khomeini radhiyallahu anhu did is that he brought Muharram, the movement of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, which has been spoken about from pulpits and manabir and in, you know, gatherings or in books or whatever since like His Eminence's martyrdom. But what Imam Khomeini did is that he took this and he totally made it practical in every aspect and dimension. He was like, this is how you live according to Hussein. This is how you die according to Hussein. This is how you become a politician, how you run a country, how you govern, how you run your banks, how you fight a war, how you based according to Hussein alayhi salam. And that was one of the most unprecedented movements that this revolution brought with itself. And I think that's what makes it so hardcore and awesome.
I think what you mentioned, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, radwanullah alayhi, what he did was, as you mentioned, he made the majalis practical.
Definitely.
He showed a manner, and even now, for example, the manner of which a society should be aiming to achieve is mentioned in that majlis. And also, because people are attached to it, they come to this majlis. It is a place where, you know, you can tell people things. You can tell them things that, you know, you may not, you know, in other times may not be able to tell them because they're more willing to listen to them.
These days, they're more willing to listen. They've got a soft spot now.
Yeah.
Just
but like in other days, and so if you wanted to tell them about certain things, it may not be, you know, possible to do so.
Yeah.
But there's also, you mentioned something about before the revolution. There was a book I came across.
You came across a book before the revolution?
Yes. That was banned. Before the revolution.
Okay, right. No, because I thought you might.
No, not me. Myself.
You are of the kind of age group that comes across books before the revolution.
No, there was a book I came across
uh-huh.
that was written before the revolution.
All right, yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
There was
I come across books like that sometimes too.
That was banned before the revolution.
Yep.
It was written by the late scholar Ayatollah Muhammad Yazdi, who passed away recently, rahmatullah alayhi.
Yeah.
And it was about this, about the majalis of Imam Hussein not being the majalis, it's just being, you know, for example, he mentions this, that he breaks it down into three categories, that of the ashraf, or the rich people, the middle mm-hmm. class, and the lower people.
Mm-hmm.
He said the lower people do it for getting their own needs, for
yeah,
barakah,
exactly.
For the nazar, what do you call
hajjad.
It? The hajjad and the requests and the
yeah.
vows and so on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The middle people do it to compete with one another.
Mm.
And the upper class do it to show off.
Exactly.
He mentions it, and he says he interviewed people, and he got, and the book was banned. So this is not the Husseini Majlis. Sheikh Mutahri also mentioned in his book that if Imam Hussein was alive, and this is obviously at that time, he would mourn for the way we mourn him.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Right? It's so ironic.
So I think the Majlis has changed a lot.
Definitely.
I think
it really
has. Changed
a lot. I think that nowadays in most societies, especially among the youth, because baby boomers can go on as much as they like about how the millennials and Gen Z are obnoxious and they don't listen and they're rebellious, and back in my day such things weren't accepted. But I think these attributes about the new generation is what makes them so adamant to discover the truth. They don't take, at a loss for a better, they don't take BS from no one.
No.
You know? They want to find out, if you want me to do this, why do I have to do it?
Why do I have to do it?
Exactly. Give me a reason. Give me proof.
And they're also, the ability to find information, or the amount of information that is out there is easy, and the easy access to it. We're not talking whether it's good or bad. That's a different discussion. But there is a lot of information mm-hmm. out there for people to go and find out, okay, is this right? Is this wrong?
Mm.
But also, there has to be my advice to my younger brothers and sisters out there. So always, if you see something, go and take it up with somebody who knows.
Mm.
You know, this is a Quranic dictum, that ask those who know.
Yeah.
And ask al-min ahl-zikr. And yeah. ask those who are in the know. Because there might be something out there, like a university, for example, they will never accept internet references. Because anybody
could just
can put anything in
the
there.
Internet,
and it
yeah.
may make sense to you. But it does not mean it is true.
True.
So with, like, and so now we're getting, with the advent of the amount of technology and the amount of information that is out there, there has to be this self-check mm-hmm. by yourself as well.
Yeah,
if you
yeah,
are not
yeah.
able to do it, ask someone who is.
Yeah, that's definitely mm-hmm. important.
Please stay with us for the next segment as we take a short break.
لك لبك يا ابن الزهراء شو رايس لبك ما لك لبك يا ابن الزهراء شو رايس لبك ما لبك يا حسين لبك يا حسين
Welcome back to our program, Youth Station, on IRIB English Radio.
While you're a youth, like, fast forward 35 years, and you're going to turn into someone that is really, you know, superficial about their religion, doesn't have a proper understanding of it, doesn't understand the philosophy behind certain things. And alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, whether through the blessing of the Islamic Revolution, or just because, I don't know, mankind as a species is becoming more woke and aware, or because technology has provided that for us, you know, provided that luxury for us to just know things, you know, because we're constantly flashed with data and information. I feel that nowadays, the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are moving toward turning into a lifestyle rather than just rituals. Though there are, I think, still regions in the world that, yeah, like the whole thing with the bedazzling a white horse and taking it around the streets and...
I mean,
Like, bro, come on.
Visionary age is not bad if it's meant like that.
But then oftentimes, come on. You got to agree that oftentimes that little means distracts people from the cause.
It does. It does. If a person is not aware of the greater cause behind it, that thing becomes the cause itself. That becomes the thing.
Exactly. It becomes the objective itself.
It becomes the objective itself, the goal itself. Like the majalis itself is not the objective. It is not. It is a means for a person to reach something higher. But majority of people, the crying, yes, these are all good things. But if they do not lead to the greater objective, they remain at that level where it is,
become stagnant.
Stagnant or unrefined. You know, in order for the majalis to become a lifestyle, as you mentioned, it has to take that next step to see the objectives behind the majalis.
Mm.
Like, for example, salah, right? Namaz or fasting or prayer, any of the rituals that we do in Islam, it is not the objective. It is not my objective to pray. It's not my objective to fast. The fasting itself is not the objective. There is something greater beyond.
Yeah, it's a tool.
It's a means to reach something. Whether I understand what is behind it or not is another issue.
Mm.
It's a different story. Am I able to understand what is behind it according to the ulama? Yes.
Mm.
Is it simple? No.
Is it for everybody? Supposed to try to find out? Absolutely.
Yes. Can you go and find out? Yes, you can. But does it mean you will find out? No. Because there are certain things beyond the realm of understanding that, you know, you have to understand with your heart.
Yeah.
And you have to have a heart that is able to accept it. Mm. And not everybody has that.
I have a lot of hope in this generation. And the thing is, because the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, though in a lot of societies, we still see that it has remained in its ceremonial form.
And that's also something important that, especially to like my niche, those people who are speaking from the mimbar, is that you have to understand who you're speaking to. If you're speaking to a group of youth, you know, like you mentioned, there's a manner of speaking.
Definitely.
You know, you don't just go one monotone in how you speak, like how you speak to the older generation.
Yeah, you don't go urwat al-wutqa.
Yeah, you know, you don't go traditionally how you would back home, for example, in a certain country or where you would do to a crowd who is used to that type of speech.
Mm.
You have to kind of adapt your way and what you say to kind of attract or at least pose certain questions to the mind of that person sitting there, you know, or create a relationship with these people. It's a little different ball game right now than what it was before, where a person would just go up, speak, and then, you know, no one will come and question
jerk
you.
A few tears,
yeah,
and then come back
no,
down.
No, it's different.
And
especially like you mentioned, people are asking why.
And I think that's a beautiful phenomenon. It's wonderful that they're asking why, that they want to become aware, that they're poking around to see, like, or for some people that I know, really dissecting the whole event to try to figure out that, okay, a man did this 1,400 years ago, got himself, his family, his loved ones, his companions killed, and then what?
Mm.
Right? And I think that is one of the most life-changing questions one can ask themselves in regard to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And it oftentimes, if they do it out of sincerity for truth-seeking, it leads to wonderful things.
Okay. That's all we have time for today, my dear listeners. Thanks for listening to us on new station on IRIB English Radio. See you next time.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/yen. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.